Okay, if I could then just begin my presentation. First of all, thank you, Sheikh, very much for your wonderful sign of solidarity and love. I'm going to make this, try to make it as brief as I can. I know you're at the end of your ability to hang on here. We have to have the strength of the Sufi to be able to endure the rest of this. We need something of the Sufi virtue here. I have your letters here. I have a couple of diagrams on the board here. Okay, just real simply here. The term cosmocentric. Okay, I don't want to say too much about that. You can come after me later if you want. But this is based upon something of a theoretical model, namely that there are a number of scholars who, when they try to give something of a theoretical classification of religions from something of an evolutionary or quasi-evolutionary point of view, they would talk, for example, about the early Sumerian polities, the Assyrian polities, the Mesopotamian polities, and so on like that. Egyptian are a kind of special border case, and so on. And pre-Confucian and pre-Taoist Chinese civilization, the early stages of Hinduism, the early Vedic period of Hinduism, prior to the more philosophical, theological texts that we call the Upanishads, which come in the period known as the very late Vedic period, the Vedanta period. In any case, in those very early societies, many scholars would say they were based upon the cosmos. There was no clear differentiation of a divine being who transcends the cosmos. And by cosmos, I mean here the physical world as it was understood in a kind of pre-scientific way in those days, human beings, societies, the sense that there is some kind of mysterious power present within the cosmos, perhaps the very cosmos itself in some sense understood as this ultimate mysterious power and so on like that. And everything was in a kind of a mix. There wasn't a clear differentiation. You know, a human being could reflect something of this divine power of the cosmos. Caves and trees could reflect it and so on. It's kind of interesting when you and human beings could reflect something of the same power that flows through animals and so on. So we use the word consubstantiality. The same substance that flows through the cosmos is the same substance that flows through human beings. In fact, in the very earliest stages, I think one could make an argument that there was no clear sense that I am a human being separate from the cosmos or separate from the gods, or there's a kind of a mix. If you were to go into some of the Paleolithic caves that we have, for example, in France, perhaps you know about the Lascaux Cave in southern France, southeastern France, and there are a few other caves too, and you'll come across paintings, very fascinating paintings, although not too many of these though we have discovered yet, but where you'll have figures which are part human, part animal, seeming to indicate, you know, that there's no clear differentiation yet between the human sphere and the animal sphere and so on. There's these perhaps the beginnings of some sense of it and so on. But in any case, so we just call that a cosmocentric understanding of reality. So you might say the empire, if you have an empire, if you could call it an empire or a kingdom, Sumerian, Babylonian, whatever, it represents the powers of the cosmos, if you want. It is it's cosmocentrically oriented and so on. Of course, the great Semitic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are religions that come onto the scene after the breakthrough to a clear sense of a divinity who transcends the world, transcends the cosmos. So it was one of the things in which we usually mean by monotheism. So the God who creates the world. God is not the world, isn't a piece of the world or a part of the world, but God himself exists in him, in the divine being itself, and the world is the result of the giftedness of God, God's desire to share in some sense with the other, which become, and when that desire to share happens, creation happens, and so on. Now, there are usually two models for thinking of this. It's rather simplistic. The one model that I would like to work with that I think fits the Christian tradition best, although we have slid into the other model from time to time, as I think some of the other religions have, is this model here. So you have the cosmos in the middle, that includes us human beings and societies of all types and so on like that. And then I'm using the mystical language from Christian mysticism, the divine ground, and you have analogies, parallels, similar in your traditions, I believe. And so you notice the divine ground. Now, I have symbolized the divine ground with broken lines simply because I'm trying to indicate there that we can't really capture, if God truly is infinite and supreme, you can't really limit God in a kind of closed circle. There's no such thing as a closed circle when it comes to divinity. We have the traditional saying in Christianity, which I think is also found in Islam and Judaism, that God is like a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. So in this system, then, we have a sense that God cannot be shrunk down into the cosmos, so to speak, and therefore God would lose the divine transcendence, if you want, the transcendence of God. But yet the lines are open to indicate that they're in relationship. They're present to one another. So that the transcendent reality is also a reality that, in some sense, transcendently permeates and is therefore present throughout the cosmos. So transcendence does not mean absence from the cosmos, but presence in the cosmos. And the presence can take various forms. God's presence in nature, God's presence in human beings, God's presence in our human conscience, God's presence in the historical revelatory traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, so on like that. Now, there is another model, of course, which I put over there in a box because I didn't want to deal with it, but it does come in here and so on, because I do think that once, and by the way, I also wanted to mention here, it seems to me that in Greek societies, I do myself follow the system of interpretation of Plato and Aristotle, which would argue that Plato and Aristotle also themselves as philosophers, but you know, in my understanding of Plato and Aristotle was very religious philosophers, mystical philosophers, especially I think Plato, and I do believe that Plato himself pretty clearly differentiated the divine ground, and he was aware of this, and Aristotle, I think, less clearly so, but I think he did as well. So they're kind of a special case, I think. I realize there are philosophers who don't agree with that reading of Plato and Aristotle, but nonetheless. Here we have dualism. Dualism is the idea, you know, that when you come to an awareness of God as transcendent, some sort of reality that really transcends us and transcends our possibilities of comprehension, and we think transcends anything finite or limited that would seem to be characteristic of the cosmos as we know, because it perishes and goes away, passes away, and so on like that. So when this something else seems to be, we become aware of it as transcendent and so on like that, I think there is a tendency sometimes to fall into what we call dualism, that is, to think not in this terms of this model, where transcendence does not mean absence from the cosmos, but presence in the cosmos, to fall into the other model where transcendence means absence from the cosmos, separation from the cosmos. So God might from time to time maybe send us messages and things like that, but by and large through angels or through intermediaries and so on, but God in the divine reality itself stays separate. And so the religious quest then becomes a quest of getting as far away from the cosmos as one possibly can. And so that you can understand then, if you have that kind of a model, issues of the relationship between God and the world, God and politics, God and society, well, there would be a tendency to say, you know, the world itself is of really no significance religiously. Political constitutions and transforming political societies is of no significance, and so on. In fact, one is more religious precisely to the degree that one gets away from that kind of stuff and is concerned with the transcendent God and so on. And I think in my reading of religious history, I think I could make a case for all of us having our tendencies to kind of move in that direction from time to time. But by and large, I would say the Christian tradition tends to fall into this stream, at least in its high intellectual theological tradition. And I think that has to do with three things, basically. One, common sense. Just staying tuned into reality and not letting theory overtake or dogmas overtake our experience of life. I think it has to do with our inheritance as Christians from Judaism, which in most of its streams, although I think there might be a little bit of this in some strands of Judaism, but by and large, I think Judaism is in this stream, and we come out of the Jewish stream. And then I would say most especially for us, it would be the incarnation, you know, God entering into the world as a human being. And I know we always get into this, how we understand that, and that's the great thing always. But obviously, if there was ever for Christians a stellar example of transcendence, God, not meaning absence from the world, but presence in it, in God's very own radical personality, in a certain sense. That kind of presence. If there was ever an example of that, it would be Christian incarnational thinking. Of course, I agree with my brother from the Sufi tradition, the Sheikh, that one of the great temptations of Christianity, precisely because we are incarnational, I think one of our great perennial temptations, which we need to always be aware of, and therefore I, in a brotherly spirit, read your reservations and the reservations from the Quran and from my Jewish brothers and sisters. I read that as a kind of cautionary critique, that you are seeing something in us, which I would myself would say, yes, I think we have fallen into that from time to time, because you see, we are kind of on the razor's edge there, aren't we? We're trying to say God has become entered into a human being in a fully personal way, but yet without falling into idolatry, and without God ceasing to be God, and without Jesus ceasing to be a human being. But because we draw the two so closely together, we are always in danger of falling in on one end or the other, and that's and we have, I think, fallen into that. But in Christianity, we call those technically heresies, by the way, but nonetheless, they're hard. We're like on that real cliff's edge all the time. Nonetheless, so this is, I think, the background then for Christian thinking generally about the relationship between Christianity and the civil world and so on like that, because you see, this is a special case of it. If you say Christianity is meant to represent God, to be a movement which represents the revelation of God in the civil society, in the world, you see, and so on like that, well, this we have to somehow do this in such a way that we respect God's godness and try to honor that, and yet at the same time, so we don't want to simply reduce God to the Christian community. We don't want to reduce God to the world. We don't want to reduce God to any political society or entity. God is God. But at the same time, we believe God is present within the world, in human beings, in nature, in society, and so on like that. And so we are a community which wants to witness to that and represent that and so on. So we're Christian state relationships are, you know, within that context and so on like that. Now,
What this has traditionally led to is an institutional distinction, I would say. I mean, it took a while for the church, for the Christian church, to work this thing through, I would say, and it's still a work in progress. And by the way, if you were to follow some thinkers, there's never going to be any concrete solution that's absolute with respect to how best to embody the presence of God within the world. In any case, there will never, all the most one can do is in any given time try to do the best one can. The relationship between the infinite and the finite is a relationship which is in principle insoluble this side of eternity. But precisely because it is so in principle insoluble, its various modes of partial solution are terribly important. But in any case, if that makes any sense to you at all. But what we kind of worked out was a twofold distinction. Going back, I would say you heard the rabbi or the doctor, Dr. Jaspi, talk about Matthew 22, you know, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Now, eventually spinning out of that and so on, you know, coming to a recognition that there are two spheres. You see, there is there's really more than two spheres, because there's the cosmos, nature, and we're becoming aware of that through modern day ecology, that the young rabbi who came in here with his doctorate in Kabbalah and spirituality represents a kind of new it's almost like a retrieval of the ancient cosmocentric consubstantial idea, but in a more complex way. The sense of ecology, you know, nature. Where is nature in the whole mix? We've concentrated so much about God and people, or God and societies. Well, there's also nature, you know, cosmos in that sense of the word. There couldn't be any people or societies without nature, and so that's we're sort of a retrieval in a certain sense of that dimension of things. In any case, Christianity then, you know, so if we kind of come out of this tradition, then we would say, well, you know, yes, I mean, on the one hand, the differentiation we've worked out, we've tried to say, well, the two spheres would be, let us say, the Christian community itself, in a certain sense, it lives within the two spheres. It lives within a sense of being in connection with the transcendent God, but at the same time, this transcendent God wants to be present within the world. And so when we look at the world, then we see that the world, you know, is a kind of complex reality. And so the two spheres have traditionally been the church and the civil society. The words that we have used traditionally in Christian political theory are the following: sphere that represents the sacred and the sphere that represents the empire. Now, the interesting thing is to keep in mind, in early Christian thinking, early Christian political thinking, it's not that God is only found in the sacred sphere, which is the primary concern of the church, and it's not that only human beings are found within the imperial or civil sphere, because remember, God is present within all the spheres and so on like that. But the emperor himself, you might say, or the political sovereign, exercises a religious function. The religious function is that he is anointed by God with the primary concern of focusing upon the needs of political civil society. And the priesthood, its fundamental concern is to witness to the eschatological kingdom of God, the notion that, and it's not just the kingdom of God, understanding that in the sense that has been interpreted in Christian history, starting with Jesus and his own proclamation of the kingdom of God, and then how that has been later interpreted in terms of Christian thought about the humanity and divinity of Jesus and so on. So thinking about how
Jesus, you might say, is the inauguration, if you will, of God's kingdom within human history, and that we are now moving towards the full realization of it, but the full realization of it will only, that's what heaven will be. Heaven will be the full realization. So that the church then is a more peculiar kind of a reality. It exists to witness primarily to the fullness of the kingdom. And the fullness of the kingdom, in a certain sense, always draws the Christian to an awareness that it will never be fully realized this side of eternity, this side of heaven. The fullness of the kingdom only happens at the final consummation, at the end of time. So it's a matter then of, or a kind of specialization of spheres, I think, if I understand it as it's worked out. And ideally speaking, it seems to me, the function of the church was, if I could just use the words of a Lutheran theologian, Wolfhart Pannenberg, because he puts it rather nicely in one of his books. He says the church's task was one, quote, of a Christian criticism of the social structure in their self-affirming form, thus aiding the transformation of society into a provisional symbol of God's kingdom. So, in other words, with that highfalutin Germanic language, but it's that ideally the church was meant to be something of a critical conscience in society, to the emperor, to the imperial powers, whatever the polity was, trying to remind them, you might say, of the fact that the needs of the civil polity are not the all-consuming or the only fundamental needs of people, but also there's the whole realm of the spirit and of preparing oneself for one's ultimate relationship with God in eternity. Now, that's a kind of a simplistic way of putting it, but I think in general that sort of covers it. Now, there are any number of deep thinkers here about this, and I think what I need to do now is a little bit is talk about something of the distinction that happened between the eastern part of the Christian Empire and the western part of the Christian Empire. As you know, Constantine moved the capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople, Istanbul, modern-day Istanbul. And this part of the world, of the Roman Empire, so to speak, so near to all of you here, was, of course, a world which had a very high civilization, because it was the world of, most immediately, Greek culture, philosophical culture, artistic culture, and so on like that. And it had, so that was kind of where the empire came and so on and settled. And then there was the whole, you know, the whole Roman legal corpus of thought and so on. They took that with them when they came to Constantinople. And all that. So it was a very sophisticated culture. The culture in the West, on the other, old Rome, you might say, old Rome, that was, other than Rome, but even Rome itself, remember it was sacked by, quote, the barbarians, and I don't like to say barbarians, but the various Germanic tribes and so on in the 400s. And so the western part of the empire was, we could call it in some sense, something of a cultural and political backwater. And particularly as you move from Rome further west into the German territories, into the French territories, and then into the Spanish territories. So the kind of the way things worked out, I think, in the West is that the function of the clergy in the West was much more involved in the political, cultural, social sphere. You're all familiar with monasticism, but I think you're more familiar here in this area with the kind of monasticism that developed in the eastern part of the empire, which was more of a contemplative kind of monasticism. Separate, you know, kind of the monk is in the desert and kind of separate from civilization and so on. Whereas in the West,
the monastic movement, by and large, became the ones who Christianized the western half of the empire. They were very involved, you might say, in bringing the faith to the various peoples all the way, and then not even just down to the bottom of Spain, but also up into England, English territories, and so on like that. And so they're the monks were more activistic, if I can put it that way, less secluded, more activistic. And also, the monks were the ones who were the preservers of civilization. So the monks were the teachers. They established the schools. They did the education and so on like that. In the early, up to about the first 1,000 years of about the year 1,000 or so on. I'm simplifying a bit. But you can see how then, so the church is much more involved in the political, cultural, social sphere. And I think what this means is then is that there was always a tendency in the West for the clergy, all the way up now to the bishops and then the Pope, to function not only as religious, as representatives of the eschatological heavenly kingdom, reminding civil society of its fragility and its finiteness and its importance, but only relative importance, and it's going to pass away. But in the West, the tendency of the popes was more and more to function as the political sovereign as well, you see. And this just fit in quite naturally with what the church, the Western arm of the church, was doing, you see, and so on like that. And of course, eventually, then this gives rise to a big struggle, because I always like to say, as the monks did their job and they did it so well, lay people got educated and they began to feel that they don't want to get pushed around anymore by the clergy, and they become aware of their own sense of dignity and their own sphere of competency, you might say. And as they become aware of their own sphere of competency, they begin to see how the clergy perhaps has become just a bit too involved in the civil sphere. Right, you know, and they compromise too much their need to be attentive to the heavenly kingdom and so on. So that's the kind of a peculiar problem in the West. Whereas in the East, you see, I think that the peculiar problem more in the East, we usually use the term Caesaropapism. In the East, the problem was more that the emperor has a tendency to function as a pope. So instead of the Pope functioning as a Caesar, it would be more the Western problem. The Eastern problem is more the emperor functioning as a Pope. The monks are off, you know, in their more contemplative mode. And the Caesar is looked at as a, you know, after all, if you look at pictures of the Caesars, the Roman emperors and so on, they're oftentimes dressed in the regalia of an Orthodox bishop, you know, with the crown and with the robe that an Orthodox bishop will wear. It's an anointing, and they're anointed to their position and so on like that. Because remember, in the teaching, God is present within the civil sphere. He's not absent from the civil sphere. So the imperial role is a God-anointed royal role, if you want. But if you have the clergy, by and large, you know, and the clergy aren't needed particularly for the civil society or for education, culture, not this particular time, you know, we're talking about a very high civilization here and so on. So I would say this, something of this kind of happens. And so you might say that the tendency in the West, at least in the, say, for about the first 1,000 years, eventually what happened was the tendency of the West was for the church to virtually control civil society, almost smother civil society, and to, in a certain sense, itself almost run the danger of losing its own primary function, which is witnessing to the eschatological kingdom of God. This would be the Western problem. And the Eastern problem would be, of course, the state smothering the church, I would say, and the church itself becoming kind of an organ of the state and somehow being controlled by the state. This is even now today, this is still a common accusation made, you know, of some of the Orthodox churches, you know, that they are still very strongly connected to their states and even controlled by them and so on like that. And as Rebecca was mentioning to me, that and Pannenberg, it's interesting, says that Wolfhard Pannenberg says this. He says the Protestant Reformation, he believes the Reformation, Protestant Reformation, is, in his terms, a sort of divine judgment on the church in the West for its, precisely for its loss of its sense of witnessing to the eternal kingdom and making itself too political. And anyway, I find that kind of fascinating. Now, this is a little bit of the background. It's much more complicated than this, you know, and there's all very important figures who come in here, but because we want to keep our body and souls together today and have some dinner, I'm going to skip them. Right now in the West, as many of you have pointed out, speaking only of the West, we are now in a period of some kind of I have in my notes here, legal separation of various dimensions between church and state. But the word, please put, if you say we're now in a period in the West of some kind of legal separation of various dimensions between church and state, in which the state is greatly influenced by non-Christian conceptions of societal order, that is, traditional non-Christian conceptions of societal order. If you use that word separation, please do me a favor and put it in quotation marks, because separation is not necessarily always the best term, you know, as our discussion with the doctor, Jewish doctor, earlier brought out. But certainly the situation, highly complex as it is, of how the church serves as some kind of critical conscience in society and represents the kingdom of God in its, hopefully, in its relative fullness to the political order, and yet does that in such a way that it doesn't lose its soul and refuses in some sense to allow the political order simply to, evacuate God from the public sphere. Because, of course, on Christian principles, try as you may to get rid of God, you just can't get rid of God. I mean, you may say God's not there, but that doesn't get rid of him. I mean, God's there. And so the question is, regardless of what you say, how can we persuasively represent and witness to the reality of God, the political order, and make that reality something meaningful in the political order? This is the issue, and I don't think there's any one simple way in which this can be done. And I think we have been for quite some time in a prolonged period of experimentation, trying to figure out ways to do this, and it varies, I think, in different cultural contexts and sovereign contexts and so on like that. Just some possibilities, though, I want to mention to you here. One possibility is that there might be a new form of the older state over church problem. A new form of the older state over church problem. Caesaropapism, if you want, in some cultural context. I'm reminded, for example, of the Polish context. The Polish context, your context, where there's such a strong interrelationship, you know, between church and state, even despite the communist takeover. The Irish should be another good example there, in a way. But right. So in some sense, even still today, in so-called democracies and so on, there is still a strong control of the church over the state in subtle ways sometimes, very, very powerful ways. And how much, for example, when the Pope, you know, the assertion, you know, of Catholicism in Poland, how much of that was Catholicism and how much of that was nationalism, you know, it's very hard to differentiate and so on. And so this is the thing, you know, and how subtly will ecclesiastical dignitaries be tempted, in other words, not to liberate
the civil sphere to achieve the fullness of its own potential, but really in a certain sense to dominate the civil sphere and not allow the fullness of people's gifts to come forth. Now remember, here we're talking about leadership, and so we have to go back again to our categories, transcendental leadership, which includes in my terminology the epistemic, but also would try to embrace not just the head, but also the heart and the will. There are people very, very, very there are authority figures who are who really rise up and issue an appeal to us and arouse a response from us, not just in the intellectual sphere, the epistemic, as I understand it, kind of existential authority, but there are people who are able to do this on the level of the will, institutions, people who really have good know-how, good practical common sense, highly trained and sophisticated in forms of organization and so on, and they have an ability to win our confidence, you might say, and lead us in that direction. There are others who, in the area of the heart, the imagination, the feelings, they just poets, artists, great speakers, visionary types, and so on. They can really move us on those deep, imaginative, intuitive, artistic levels. And sometimes you have the existential types who can do all three, which is a blessed thing. And then you have the authority of office, the complex authority of office, in the civil sphere, of course, and in the ecclesiastical sphere. And sometimes it is not impossible for somebody to have, as we know, the authority of office and to have existential authority at the same time. It's just hard to figure out how that happens, but I remember in my own tradition, Pope John the 23rd, who struck me very much as an example of somebody who was a fascinating combination, who won a lot of hearts, you know, and so on. And he had the authority of office, and yet he had the, on some levels, existential authority, you know, that really captured people and won people over and so on like that. Perhaps our current pontiff, for many people, does the same thing in the West, in the Catholic tradition, and so on. But in any case, I think that is still an issue that's there, and I think still a temptation and so on like that. The other possibility, you know, of instead of the state smothering the church, of course, I think is still a possibility. Still a possibility. The state, I mean, the church smothering the state, or not really working for the full liberation of the civil liberties of its people. I think that's still a subtle possibility that the church needs to be always vigilant on. I would say that the other issue there, of course, the state smothering the church, smothering the Christian community, of course, this, of course, in the West has been a real difficulty. We, of course, have the great paradigmatic examples of Nazism in Germany, which attempted to eradicate Catholicism and Protestantism by basically setting up their own Protestant church and their own Protestant Nazi bishop, the Reich Bischoff, and basically in a certain sense trying to neutralize the Catholic hierarchy through various agreements, concordats, and so on. We'll make a concordat with you, but the price will be that you will keep quiet and this and that and so on. There are, of course, examples of martyrs and heroes who disagreed with these policies, both in the Evangelische Kirche, in Germany and in the Catholic Church, but I'm talking about a general sort of thing. So that's a paradigmatic example. Another example, of course, would be the communist lands where communism has come in, of course, Poland, again, the southeastern Slavic territories right now, China, still communist territory. You can kind of see then how you have a situation of where the imperium now is radically secular, and not only secular but atheistic, and not only atheistic but anti-theistic, just against God, and will do everything it can to snuff out the sphere of the sacred, so to speak, and so on like that. So that is a those are obvious examples. To what extent in the Western world our current Pope worries about this is the modern commercial capitalist world
a world which runs the danger of substituting a new kind of narcissism and selfishness and ego, a kind of egoism in a certain sense. To what extent is there something there as well that in a very subtle way runs the danger of snuffing out the sacred sphere, so to speak? So the problem, you know, we meet the problem in various forms. In America, of course, it's very, very difficult to figure out how to witness to the transcendent in the civil sphere when we have so many competing groups, some of whom are really desperately trying to silence the voice, the representative voices of the transcendent in society. So that's where we are, and I could say much more, but there's other possibilities. Maybe I just end with this. My friend Karl Rahner, you've heard me quote Karl Rahner before. The reason why I quote him a fair amount is, you know, Austrian-German theologian, didn't die too long ago, and I did my doctoral dissertation on him, and have a great fondness for him and consider him one of the great philosophical and theological thinkers of the contemporary period. But he was of the opinion, I don't know, this might be another thing. He talked about how he argued that in the German society of his own time, he thought that a lot of what passes for Catholicism was what he called a folk Catholicism, you know, that it was you became a Catholic because you were born that way, although you can't be born a Catholic, but really in a certain sense, let's face it, folks, a lot of us are born into our faith heritages, even if, you know, Christians, you're baptized, but, you know, we're born. I mean, we're born into Catholic families or Christian families, and we're raised that way and so on, and by the time you're old enough to think things through, it's so deeply ingrained into, you know, emotionally on all sorts of deep levels, it'd be very, very difficult to entertain other possibilities, and so on. So these are, again, that's that kind of subtle interrelationship between the transcendent and the worldly, right? How God works through, you know, you can make that case. God works through families and through cultures and ethnicity and so on, but when does that working through all of that end up reducing God to those things, you see? And that's always that difficult thing, and so on like that. But Rahner held that what he thought, that Christianity in its powerful institutionalized form in Germany would just shrink more and more as society became more and more secular. Yeah, but he thought that, the Christian, the way he put it in a famous sentence was to say that the devout Christian of the future will either be a mystic, that is, one who has experienced something, or he will cease to be anything at all. So that he looked at the future then as an opportunity and a challenge of people then to really own their particular faith perspective on an experiential, not just because you're born into it, not just because it's the cultural thing to do, but because it is really deeply the profound experience of your being, you might say. The ground of being becomes your ground in a real profound existential sense. To quote, well, I don't think he was quoting Paul Tillich, but they'd be kindred souls in some ways. So those are our various range of possibilities. And so there's various kinds of leaders that we've talked about. Their function then is somehow to figure out in their own concrete socio-cultural context how best to keep this relationship alive. Not an easy task.
Hey, very interesting, that last quote from Karl Rahner. It brings us right back to the conversation we had with the Benedictine Abbot, doesn't it? But the goal of every Christian is to become a mystic and looking at historical challenges that way. Bill, one question. Can you thematize this excellent survey of church-state relations in the context of the contemporary tensions of South and North in relationship to Christianity, the emergence of a different South Christianity, otherwise, for those not familiar, more third world type, and how the church-state thing plays itself out that way?
I don't know. You're moving beyond my comments. I've read there's been some controversial books coming out on it. You know, is that what you're referring to? Are you referring to some of the controversial writings that have come out on this? You're referring to South America, Central America, North America?
Asia, Africa,
Asia, Africa, more complex, yeah.
The whole idea of the emergence of two different Christianities, the southern one and the northern one, and how power politics played differently in those two kinds of Christianity.
But it's just so much, you know, to deal with. I think it's a very, very important question. I think I would have opinions to make about it, some of those contexts, but golly, I just don't. I mean, obviously, if you take South America and Central America, the presence of Spain, you know, the religious presence of Spain, and so there's still much of the old empire, the traditional Christian empire, the Catholic tradition there, and so on. Yeah. That's there. So that plays itself out, I think, rather strongly. Although, obviously, modern-day liberal models from America are working their way in there. And so I think that's the thing there. So, you have the Marcia mentioned liberation theology. And, of course, liberation theology would be, in some sense, and feminist forms of theology are coming in now more strongly. Well, there is no the liberation theology. There's various forms of it. But it's this, let's just say, in general, it's a highly complex thing. It's like Joseph's blanket, you know. It's very colored and textured. But in general, it's a criticism of the older tendency of the... See, what happened was, in a certain sense, you might say, the traditional forms of Catholicism, in a certain sense, by and large, kind of got imposed upon civil society, and to such an extent, though, that civil society was not really, in a certain sense, enabled to achieve the full flowering or the fullest possible flowering in their own situation of their own human rights and dignity and so on like that. So liberation theology, I think, particularly on behalf of the poor, is a criticism of that tendency, part of the church and so on like that. So I would say that's there. But the South Asian one is a more complex one. I don't know what's really going to happen there. So many of those bishops, you know, in Southeast Asia they've been trained in Rome. Every time they get together, this is the Catholic part. Now I can't. The Protestant part is a different thing too. But every time they get together, they usually kind of want to work for a church which is much more involved in civil society and much more in dialogue with it and much more tolerant. But then somehow the word comes down from Rome that they need to kind of, like, on some of the more radical issues, tone their rhetoric down, and they always seem to do that. I don't know exactly why that is. We have a strong tendency in Catholicism, you know, to when the Papa speaks, we have a tendency to, in the family, we fight.